Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that this month marks 5 years since Premier Insight was launched, bringing you this and many other podcasts designed to deepen your faith. Since 2020, God has used this ministry to reach millions with over 20 million downloads of Premier Insight content, including one longtime atheist who shared, "I find this show and its guests deeply engaging as I continue on my personal faith journey." This ministry is completely reliant on the support of friends like you. That's why on this anniversary month, we're asking you to take just a moment and provide whatever gift is possible to keep this ministry going strong. If you believe this kind of ministry is needed and that more people need to be reached with this content, then I'm asking you to respond with a gift today. Just visit premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow today. Thank you for your generosity. And now, let's get into today's episode.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. You can find out much more about the programme, extra features, videos, resources, and of course this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD. That's all available from the website premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable, and links there, of course, to the book I recently published telling the story of this show for over 10 years and why I'm still a Christian after over 10 years of talking with atheists. Again, if you want to find out more, you can go to the website of the show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And following on from Unbelievable this afternoon between 4 and 5, you can hear my conversation with Carlos Anocondia. He's an Argentinian evangelist who's been at the forefront of a charismatic revival for the last few decades in Argentina. So look out for that between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. It has been an extraordinary week here in Britain, and whether you're listening via Premier Christian Radio in the UK or further afield via the Unbelievable podcast, thanks to all those who've written in with thoughts, prayers and condolences regarding the attack that took place not long after the Manchester attack, but this time in London, that took place last Saturday night, just after last week's show broadcast, actually. And I do appreciate that. It has, of course, also been an eventful week in politics, with the British general election taking place. And now we look at a hung parliament and a coalition government. So again, thanks for those who have been in touch regarding that. But we're going to be turning our mind today to other matters, to the thought of things we often address on this programme. Today we've got a Christian and non-Christian coming to you to tell you why they do and don't believe, and particularly looking at one particular argument for God. Welcome to Unbelievable. Let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, I'm joined by Frank Turek. He's a Christian apologist, speaker and radio host, and author of books including I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist and Stealing from God. He was on the show a few months ago talking to David Smalley. He was the atheist guest then. Today, it's Alex O'Connor returning. He's the atheist YouTube channel Cosmic Skeptic. It has over 100,000 subscribers. He's appeared on the show a couple of months ago to debate the fine-tuning of the universe. Well, today I've got Frank and Alex joining me in studio. Frank has been in the UK doing some speaking dates. You can find out more about him at his website, crossexamined.org. And Alex, as I say, Cosmic Skeptic is the YouTube channel he runs. Back to debate with Frank today, because Alex released a video a while back critiquing a YouTube video by Frank. Now, Frank's video is titled, "It May Just Be That Evil Disproves Atheism." Well, Alex had a critique to make of that, and we're going to be hearing what Alex's response is. And that's really the subject of our discussion today. Does evil prove that God exists? That's the claim, in a sense, that Frank Turek makes in this video, something we've discussed before, but I think we're going to be doing it from some unique angles today. And I'm really looking forward to today's conversation. So, Alex and Frank, welcome along to the program.
Great to have you. Me again.
Yeah, wonderful being here in person, Justin.
Well, it's lovely to have you in person, Frank. We've had you on the Skype a little while back earlier in the year, talking about your new book, Stealing from God, and as I say, in debate with David Smalley. And it's lovely to actually have you in person. When I heard you were coming to the UK, I wanted to make sure we could connect.
Well, thanks for having me on. And, you know, I just had you on my program for your new book.
Yes, indeed.
Unbelievable.
I'm flogging it far and wide. So.
It's a wonderful book, Justin. It really
I won't
is.
Let you leave without a copy as well, by
Indeed.
The way,
yeah.
Alex. So, but yeah, thank you. Very glad that you were able to endorse it as well, Frank. But you're here to talk about yourself, really, today and your ministry and obviously some of the videos and books that you've written yourself. How long have you been kind of involved in the sort of apologetics ministry you've established?
Well, we established a ministry in 2006, but I went to seminary from 1993 on. I was on the Moses plan. It took me 80 years to get through, but I'd been speaking for quite a while prior to 2006, but we started in 2006 with crossexamine.org, primarily to go to college campuses, because as you know, the college campus is a breeding ground for skepticism and agnosticism and atheism, so we wanted to go there and present evidence as to why Christianity was true from our book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist.
And some of the most popular videos, actually, that go on YouTube that you produce are actually some of your interactions with
right.
some of the students on these campuses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's people like to hear the kind of the to and fro in a way.
Right.
And you're very good, actually, at thinking on the spot and responding in those situations.
Well, actually, you don't have to do much thinking because you hear the same 20 questions over
sure.
and over again.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there are the standard objections, which are good objections. In fact, the evil is a good objection that Alex brought up. So it's good to try and unpack these things in more than 2 minutes, which is why I appreciate this show so much, Justin, because, look, I can do a 2-minute video. Alex can do a 2-minute video. And you're really not going to cover the topic
sure.
adequately.
Yeah.
But when
yeah.
you have a program like this, you can really interact on it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with me, Frank. And again, the most recent book you've authored is Stealing from God. Do you just want to quickly give us an encapsulation of what you can find in that?
Sure. The book Stealing from God, the subtitle is Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. The book's not about tithing Christians. You know, that's not what it's about. But I've noticed it seems to me that atheists are stealing aspects of reality that would only exist if God existed in order to say he doesn't exist. And we have an acronym in the book, CRIME, C-R-I-M-E-S, and each of the letters stands for a different aspect of reality that I think atheists are stealing from God to say he doesn't exist. One of them, the E in there, is evil, and that's what we'll talk about today. I think, as we'll see, that evil actually shows God does exist rather than he doesn't exist.
Mm. Okay. Well, we'll obviously be digging into that in the course of today's show. Lovely to have you back, Alex.
Lovely to be here.
And I'm in awe because you're actually, and I don't know how you get away with it, really, but you're midway through your exams at the moment, and yet you've made time to come in and record a discussion.
Indeed, yeah.
And these are, of course, A-level exams as well. You're,
yes.
you're a relatively young person, but wise beyond your years, I think. You did a fantastic job last time you came in debating the fine-tuning argument, so I thought this would be fun to have you back in. So, first of all, exams going okay?
They're going as yeah. well as they could be. are going fine because I was pretty much familiar with most of the subject matter already, so I could kind of get away with not revising for that one.
Well, that's good. Obviously, I guess you interact with philosophical ideas quite regularly on your videos anyway.
I do try.
So it's a good way of getting into it. And the Cosmic Skeptic channel, as I mentioned last time, only been going about a year, but already you've over 100,000 subscribers.
That's right.
What's the secret to your success?
Like I said last time, if I knew, I would do it again. they're all fantastic. Every one of my subscribers, at least the ones that I interact with, are incredible. They're,
yeah.
they're very willing to consider different ideas, and I get messages from people of all faiths saying that they're grateful for a voice that isn't just castrating religious
right,
people,
yeah.
But is going in there for a discussion, not to defend yeah. a worldview, but to...
Well, I was really encouraged, actually, when we had the discussion last time here in the studio, that you were very... You reached out to atheists and said, we need to have these discussions. We can't just, you know, poo-poo and dismiss religion and the claims. We need to engage in an honest conversation, which is certainly what this program is about.
Well, I mean, humour and ridicule has its place.
Mm.
But if you want to make a change, then you have to take things seriously, I think.
Well, thank you very much for coming back on the program today. And part of the reason I asked you, of course, is because you regularly respond to other online videos that are out there. And, of course, one of the ones that you've responded to is one of Frank's videos. And as I say, that video was titled, It May Just Be That Evil Disproves Atheism. So we're going to get into that in the course of today's program and why you disagree with Frank. There's a number of issues that you develop from the video. We won't play the audio of the video this time. Rather, we'll let you explain for yourself. But some of the things that we're going to try and tackle is at the outset, you say you can't disprove atheism. It's not a belief system. We're going to be talking about objective morality. Why would it be grounded in the Christian God, not something else? You also talk about the evolutionary or social adaptation type of view of how morality came to be, and other issues. We'll see how much time we have in the course of the discussion, and I'm looking forward to a really good conversation between you guys. If you're listening and you'd like to respond to anything you hear on today's show, you can always email, of course, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via our Facebook and Twitter accounts too, @unbelievablejb to follow the show on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook account of the show. You can find all those links and more, plus today's show, to comment underneath at the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the programme, we're asking a question we have tackled before, but with my two guests, Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor today. Does evil prove that God exists, or does it give evidence for God? Often, of course, the problem of evil and suffering is a key objection to the existence of a good and loving God. But in a video, Frank Turek makes the case that actually, to even have a concept of evil, you need to have a God. And of course, we heard the response from Alex O'Connor on his video response on his Cosmic Skeptic channel. Well, let's maybe start with you, Frank, just to lay out, you know, briefly at least, what the case is that you're making on the video that Alex was responding to.
Right. It's a 2-minute video. And I say in the front, you can't cover this whole issue in 2 minutes. But my main point is this, is that if evil exists, then good must exist. And in order for good to exist, God must exist. Because by definition, what we mean by good is the nature of God. That's what goodness is. So you can't have evil unless good exists, because evil is a privation or a lack in good. Evil is like rust in a car. You know, if you take all the rust out of the car, you got a better car. If you take all the car out of the rust, you've got nothing. In other words, evil only exists as a parasite in good. And so I think we all agree evil exists. The question is, if evil exists, then how can it exist unless there's a standard of good? And good won't exist unless God exists. So evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, but evil doesn't disprove God, because there'd be no such thing as evil unless there was good, and there'd be no such thing as good unless God existed. Now, the second question there, of course, is, okay, well, if there is a good God, why would he allow these evil things to occur? That's another question,
right,
which we spend a lot of time in the book, stealing from God. But my main point is that if evil exists, God exists. I know it sounds counterintuitive.
It does sound counterintuitive. Yeah. To the average person, they'll say, how do you get from one to the other? But as I understand it, this is this is the idea of what's often called the moral argument for God. That if we all agree that real right and wrong exist, real good and evil exist, then there has to be some kind of a moral lawgiver or some kind of reference frame that beyond just the material universe that a naturalist perhaps believes.
In fact, C.S. Lewis famously said that as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how would I got this idea of justice and injustice? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, injustice can't exist unless justice exists, and justice can't exist unless God exists, because, again, by definition, that's what we mean by justice.
And so it's your view that if an atheist wants to claim that justice and injustice exist, well, they can't really, because that's just, on their framework, an illusion, a kind of just a sort of something that we've come up with as a sort of helpful way of thinking about things, but not something that actually exists objectively.
Right, typically. And I think that's what Alex said in his video, that it's an illusion, that this idea that we have these moral, objective moral values is illusory.
Well, let's come to Alex for this. And we'll try and sort of take the points that you raised in the video in a kind of sequential manner as far as possible, Alex. But, I mean, let's start at the beginning, because in the video, the first point you wanted to make was that there is this question mark around disproving atheism. That's obviously the title of the video. It may just be that evil disproves atheism. You have a problem with that very concept to start with, don't you?
To an extent, yeah. It's not particularly pertinent to the discussion. But I think it's important to remember that, according to me, atheism isn't a worldview. And I know this is something you disagree with, Frank, but the way that people get around this a lot of the time is they'll say, well, many atheists do believe that there is no God. But not all atheists do. So if you meet a person who does believe there is no God, they are an atheist. But that's not what atheism is. That's sort of a subset of atheism. I'm what you might call an agnostic atheist. And a lot of people think that agnosticism and atheism are on the sort of same spectrum, but to me they're absolutely not. agnosticism, Matt Dillahunty is good on this. Agnosticism is a claim to knowledge. Atheism is a claim to belief. So to say you're agnostic is to say, well, I don't know if there's a God, which I think is the rational position to take. I mean, can anybody really know for sure? Mm. And all I'm saying is because I don't know agnosticism, I therefore don't believe, and that's atheism. But there are people out there who do actively believe there's no God. And those people do have a burden of proof. I mean, people such as, he only did it on one occasion that I've seen, but Christopher Hitchens usually would say, you know, we would never say there is no God. But when talking to William Lane Craig, he said of the Christian God that he is quite dangerously, I think, but he said that he's in a position where he thinks he can actively say that God does not exist. And in that case, yes, he has a burden of proof. But as far as I'm concerned, atheists in general, or atheism, isn't a worldview and doesn't...
It isn't something you can therefore disprove in that sense.
Yeah, in the sense... Mm-hmm. And also atheism, one of the phrases that I've heard you use, Frank, is on atheism, if atheism is true. But to me, atheism isn't something that can necessarily be true or false any more than, say, veganism. You know, is veganism true? It's not really a case of whether it's true or false. It's a case of the tenets on which you are grounding this veganism is perhaps maybe you think it's wrong to eat animals. That can be true or false. Mm-hmm. But not objectively, I'd say. But that can be true or false. But then to say, is veganism itself true or false? Uh-huh. That doesn't make any sense. It's not whether it's true or false. It's are you a vegan or are you not?
Okay. Frank? Yeah, well, I would say that if... Are you saying that atheism is just a lack of belief in God?
Because it is for me, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, but well, then that would be just a statement about your psychological state.
Yes.
It wouldn't be a statement about the real world.
Well,
because
no.
this book is an atheist then, because it lacks a belief in God. But then we're really trivializing what the word atheist means then.
Yes.
Because you could say any this microphone's an atheist then, if it just lacks a belief in God. So if somebody wants to say that, okay, fine, but I don't see atheists just saying that. What I see is atheists saying, oh, I lack a belief in God, and here's how I explain the universe. Multiple universes, evolution, quantum vacuums, materialism. Well, those are positive beliefs that need to be defended. In other words, you just can't say, I lack a belief in God, and therefore I have no burden of proof to have a conversation about why reality is the way it is. No, if you're going to say that multiple universes or evolution or materialism or quantum vacuums explain how we got here, then it would seem to me you'd need reasons for those. Those are positive beliefs. You see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. In certain cases, for instance, if you're talking about the variety of life and somebody says to me that they think it was God, and I said, oh, no, I can explain this for evolution. I suddenly have a burden of proof. I have to offer some evidence for that.
Right, right.
But atheism in general, if you're just an atheist and you're not taking part in debate, I think you don't necessarily have to justify your position.
What do you do with
the
problem that makes cats and rocks and microphones atheists as
well? Well, it depends on your definition. For instance, if we define a vegan as someone who doesn't eat meat, then this book is also a vegan.
Right. Yes, but that isn't that the point, that that makes it difficult to understand what the content is of such a point of view?
I don't think it makes it difficult to understand. I think it's something which applies to humans. You can call a human an atheist. If you want to call a book an atheist, then be my guest, because by my definition, an atheist is someone who does not believe in God.
Mm.
And so a book, sure, call it an atheist you will.
But then we wouldn't have any reason to converse about anything. If you're just saying you lack a belief in God and I don't have any burden of proof to explain reality or why reality is the way it is, then we're not really having a conversation, right?
Well, there's two types of atheist speakers, you might say.
Uh-huh.
The first is people who will have a burden of proof, who come out and there are two people trying to prove their opposing worldviews against each other. In the other case, there's somebody like me who, in the face of certain aspects of Christianity, I've found to be not particularly compelling or particularly... I'm trying not to use moral terms here, to be very careful. But and so what I will do, my mission isn't...
He's very smart.
My mission is not to come out and convert everyone to atheism. It's rather to say, well, here's a belief system that I don't agree with, and here's why. I'm then leaving it open. Perhaps if I'm debating with a Christian, I might say, well, this is why I think Christianity isn't true. Now go and do your own thing. Maybe you want to be a Muslim. Maybe you want to be an atheist like me.
All right, let me ask you this, though. Let's just say that you say you think Christianity is false because of X, whatever that is, right?
Sure.
Aren't you implying that non-X then is true?
Not necessarily. Again, it's a very subtle distinction between believing there is no God and not believing there is a God. It sounds like the same thing. It sounds like we're being pedantic. But really, in all honesty, it is a semantic thing. It doesn't particularly matter because, for instance, what we're discussing today, the idea of evil proving or disproving God, I don't think it particularly matters how you're defining atheism or Christianity, because what we're trying to talk about is a particular concept. And so for this discussion, I might just be a skeptic, not necessarily an atheist, but I might just be somebody who you are trying to present a worldview to, and I'm just saying, well, let me criticize that and see if I can get some kind of response.
When I've had this conversation on Twitter and on this show with people, sometimes what's emerged is that they will say, you know, they'll go with that atheism is just a lack of belief in God view. Mm. But then when you press them a bit, they will come out with other things that they do have positive beliefs about, so that there is no such thing as objective moral right or wrong.
Right.
The universe has no purpose. Mm-hmm. All that exists is matter and motion, ultimately, and those kinds of things. So do you subscribe in that sense to something like, for instance, materialism, naturalism, and
well,
so on?
Well, for me, it's a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
So I wouldn't call myself a naturalist. I wouldn't call myself a materialist, because all of a sudden you're giving yourself a burden of proof.
What I
would say is, if you pressed me to put some money, I'm not a gambling man, but if I had to put some money on either say Christianity or naturalism, a better explanation for the universe, I put my money on naturalism.
Okay.
And so when I have discussions like this, I will argue in that mindset.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to
say... But you're still agnostic, effectively, as to what exactly...
If you're talking about a claim to knowledge, absolutely. I would never be so arrogant as to say that I know that there is no God. Or I would never say that I know that there is someone up there, and I know who he is, I know his gender, I know his nature, and I know what his plan is and what he wants for me.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're dealing more with probability than we are with absolute certainty. And you remember Richard Dawkins famously said this, on a scale of 1 to 7, where one is, I'm sure God exists, to 7, I'm sure there isn't a God. He said, I'm a 6.5.
Mm.
To his credit, he says, look, I can't say with absolute certainty there is no God. Okay,
yes.
So we're all dealing in the realm of probability. So where would you be on that scale?
I'm in the same place as Dawkins. I'm a number 6. He calls it a de facto atheist, which I think is the perfect term. For all intents and purposes.
You assume there is no God for all intents and purposes.
For all intents and purposes. What I would say is, rather than I assume there is no God, rather I think that everything seems to work without the assumption that a God is there.
But wouldn't an agnostic be about a 3.5?
Agnosticism, again, is a claim to knowledge rather than to belief. So agnosticism, to me, if you don't call yourself an agnostic, then I can't quite understand what knowledge you have that I don't. I mean, I don't know if you're the sort of person to say, I know there is a God.
Again, it's the realm of probability. Am I absolutely certain? No,
I'm not
certain that I exist. You know, I mean, I guess I have to exist to say
exactly.
it. But I mean, we could be, you know, the famous famous thought experiment. We could... The universe could have been created 5 minutes ago. We're an experiment in a scientist's laboratory, and you know, we just have all these memories.
Well, you've got people like Elon Musk who do think that we're some kind of artificial intelligence.
That's a discussion for another time.
But, yeah. Right.
What I would say, though, is I like to categorize it. And, of course, this is, again, semantics. It's just my way of categorizing the world. What I would say is, if you think of four boxes, like a table, across the top you have theism and atheism. And on the side, you have Gnosticism and agnosticism. You say you're not 100% sure that there is no God, so I'd put you in the agnostic box. Then I'd put you across on the theism box because you believe there is a God, and that's where you sit. You're an agnostic theist, as far as I'm concerned. Now, you can reject that label because you might have a... I know that the word agnostic carries weight, so you might not like
I think maybe
like
we ought to stop talking about labels and start talking about evidence.
Absolutely.
Let's move it on. It's been a fascinating discussion so far, talking about the definitions of atheism and agnostics and so on. But, we should get into the meat of the subject today, which is the question of whether evil is evidence, actually, that God exists, counterintuitively. That's the claim in that you sort of sketched out for us earlier on, Frank. So let's move on to sort of the second issue that you bring up in your response video, Alex, which is, even if objective morality does exist, why would it be grounded in the Christian God and not something else? Do you want to just explain that out a bit and we'll see what Frank has
to say? Well, again, this isn't... this is one of the parts of the video that I'm not really making an actual claim, but rather I'm a genuine question. More out of interest than anything is how do you arrive at the Christian God? Although I would say that I might assume that your answer might be something along the lines of, well, this argument just proves a God, and then other arguments prove the Christian God, and that is fine by me. But I wonder, do you think... if you say no to this doesn't disprove your position in any shape, in any way, shape, or form. But do you think that for objective morality, it must be the Christian God?
No, it could be another god, right? Mm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's what I was going to say, that there are other arguments. You don't get all the way to the Christian god with the moral argument.
Sure.
But with other arguments, I think, in my opinion anyway, you arrive at the grounding for morality as God, and that God happens to be the Christian god.
Let me put it the other way, I guess, to you, Alex. If objective morality did exist, would it at the very least disprove atheism, which is actually what the title of the video is?
Well, this is a tricky thing, because
or naturalism, let's say.
Okay, sure.
So we don't do that same discussion.
Perhaps. Okay. It would be compelling. I would see it as a compelling argument. If you could prove to me that objective morality did exist, I would certainly consider it a good argument
because naturalism would not be able to explain that phenomenon.
Sure. I mean, perhaps it would, and we just don't have an understanding.
Right.
But I would submit that, yes, we do not have, in our current understanding, any way. Sam Harris has tried the moral landscape.
Yes.
What I found is that I don't quite understand what he's getting at, because he says he wants to prove objective morality using science. But what he does is he proves that, objectively speaking, certain moral guidance leads to prosperous societies. But then that's assuming that prosperous societies is a good thing.
He makes the ought is fallacy, in my my opinion. He assumes that what science describes is something we ought to be heading for, and of course that begs the whole question of his project.
Sure, I think he's a brilliant thinker, but on this issue I cannot bring myself to agree with him.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, I think we've more or less covered that issue, because obviously you're not saying this is a wholesale argument for the Christian God, just part of a cumulative argument.
Right, exactly.
And that point in the video is more for people who were watching, perhaps, who were thinking along those lines.
Sure. Well, look, that's a good point at which for us to take a quick break, and then we'll concentrate on some of the other issues that arose in that video in the next section of the programme. But we've got off to a flying start on today's programme, and a lovely good tone to this conversation today between Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor. Frank is a Christian apologist, speaker, and radio host of Cross Examined. You can check out his website, crossexamined.org. Great to have him in the UK at the moment. And if you want to check out his books, Stealing from God is the latest one. I'll make sure there are links from today's show. Alex O'Connor runs the atheist YouTube channel Cosmic Skeptic. He has over 100,000 subscribers and loads of videos you might be interested in watching. And we're talking about the response video he had to Frank. As we asked today, does evil show that God exists? We'll be back in a moment's time with the second part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon.
Premier and SPCK invite you to London Bible Week. Your opportunity to hear renowned speakers Tom Wright, Krish Kandaya, Elaine Storkey, Rowan Williams, Celia Appiedi Collins and Calvin Samuel, with worship led by Lou Fellingham. Meet Jesus in God's Word and hear what God is really saying to us. London Bible Week, from the 17th to the 22nd of July at Emmanuel Centre, Westminster. Revealing truth, meeting Jesus in God's Word.
For tickets and information, visit londonbibleweek.com.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of this week's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's the show that brings you conversations that matter every week as I bring Christians and skeptics into dialogue. If you want to find more of them, download them as a podcast and find more resources besides, do go to the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to the newly released Unbelievable book, where you can find me talking about the story of the show, over 10 years of the show. Frank's waving it in front of the webcam that we're using to record this for Alex's channel as well. If you want to get hold of that, it's available as well from the website or from its own site, unbelievablebook.co.uk. A pleasure to be joined in studio today by two very intelligent men, Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor. Frank's a seasoned Christian apologist. He has his own radio show out in the States. I've been on it a couple of times, actually, Cross Examined. And if you want more about him, crossexamined.org is his website. His latest book, Stealing from God, makes the case that various aspects of our understanding of reality are sort of have been nicked, robbed, borrowed from the Christian worldview. And one of them is the whole idea of evil. And if you're going to talk about evil, you really have to talk about God. Alex O'Connor of the YouTube channel Cosmic Skeptic says, not the case, actually, Frank, and he's done a video responding to him. So we're getting back into today's conversation. If you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the show, do encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can leave comments as well underneath the latest edition of the show at the website. You can get in touch via Facebook and the other social media ways too. We'll hear some of your feedback towards the end of today's show to some recent programmes. But I think it's time to grab the bull by the horns, Frank, and just, again, reiterate why you believe, first of all, that morality does have this objective nature to it, so that there is a real realm of moral right and wrong, good and evil. Because fundamentally, you're saying if evil does exist, as much as that may be a problem for why a loving God would allow evil, nonetheless, it's a signpost that something beyond the material world has to exist to allow this realm of good and evil
to
exist.
In fact, I think Alex recognizes that signpost because on his website, he rails, I think rightfully, against some of the abuses of the Roman Catholic Church, where he talks about how priests have sexually abused children. And obviously, that's a great wrong. Mm. But my question is, Alex, if you really think that is a great wrong, why would you deny objective morality? I mean, is that really wrong, or is it just a matter of personal opinion?
Well, I think that we agree in one sense that evil doesn't necessarily disprove God. I'm with you on that. Mm-hmm. What I would say is to answer your question, objectively, no. It is a subjective thing. Morality, to me, is entirely subjective.
Why do you say that?
Well, because, firstly, a thing to note is that objective morality... Well, let's talk about what objective actually means, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Objectivity, to me, if you want my definition, would be to say that it is true regardless of human intervention, regardless of human consciousness. For instance, the Earth orbits the Sun. That would be true if all humans disappeared,
right?
Every single one of them. It would still be an objective fact. Mm-hmm. But to say that murder is wrong, if every human disappeared, that couldn't still be wrong, surely. That would be a nonsense concept without some kind of human psychology. The only way that you could argue that perhaps it would still be wrong is if there was some kind of transcendent being. But then you need to have that being in order to prove the existence of the objective morality that you're then using to prove the God. So.
But what we're doing is we're reasoning from effect to cause, that we have this effect known as this moral law that is pressing on us. As you admitted in the video, and look, videos, 2-minute videos, 10-minute videos, you can't expound on all the nuances. So if this is wrong, correct me. But you seem to say that we, in fact, I think you quoted, the quote was, let me just quote you accurately on this, because in the video you said this. You said moral truths are so deeply ingrained in us that they feel like they are objective.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So my question is, why would you doubt their objective if they're so deeply ingrained in us?
Well, because this is where I think Sam Harris is right, in the sense that if you have certain assumptions, so let's say that we could assume that human well-being was a good thing. We'll discuss why shortly, but let's say we assume that. We could then say that it is objectively true that we should act in certain ways, for instance, trying not to murder people. That would then become an objective morality.
Right.
So because evolution has instilled within us, through genetics, a drive to stay alive, then we can derive objective moral truths about how we should act in order that complies with this inner nature, which I think has come about through evolution. So even if you don't subscribe to the idea that certain moral actions, such as not killing or not stealing, have come about through evolution, the instinctual nature within us to stay alive causes us to think of those as objective truths, but it's a technicality. So for all intents and purposes, you could say they're objective truths. If you grab 100 people off the street and ask them, is rape wrong? 100 of them will say yes, but that doesn't mean it's objective. I mean, for instance, I put it to you, would you say that chocolate is tasty?
Yeah, I would, but that's a subjective.
Right,
you know,
sure.
Some people may not like chocolate.
It's subjective.
Yeah.
That's
a flavor.
So tar can be just as tasty as chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
But that's no problem, right? That's no problem whatsoever. So when you say something along the lines of, so morality's subjective. So what Hitler did being wrong was just an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, but in the same sense that chocolate tasting as good as tar is an opinion.
See, I think
it doesn't make a difference.
Well, no, I think it does, because it's much more obvious that, say, sexually abusing children is wrong than atheism's true.
Right.
So why would you say that atheism's true in order to avoid the obvious conclusion that sexually abusing children is wrong. You already know sexually abusing children is wrong. Now, if you want to use an evolutionary argument, the problem is that undercuts everything you think. Because if everything we think is the product of evolution, the product of the laws of physics or biology, mm-hmm. whatever it is, then why should we believe anything we think? Forget about morality for a second. Why should we even believe that atheism is true or that Christianity is true? If our thoughts are the result of some random evolutionary process, why should we believe anything we think is true?
Well, the first thing is that evolution isn't a random process. But that aside, it's
let me put it this way: it's either directed by an outside intelligence or it's not.
Sure, okay. I'll
if it's
that.
Not directed by an outside intelligence, then it's random.
Yes. So,
if it's directed by intelligence, then perhaps God exists. If it's not directed by intelligence, why should we believe anything we think?
Because, I mean, this is the old argument against naturalism that, mm-hmm. that people like
C.S. Lewis
mm-hmm. and indeed modern practitioners like Plantinga have put forward, which, as I understand it, is effectively saying if evolution is, if effectively it's meant for the propagation of our DNA, mm-hmm. it's not aimed at us receiving true beliefs. It's not aimed at us actually. It's not aimed at reasoning.
No.
And ultimately, you could even go as far as to say that the actual processes of matter in motion, atoms banging into each other, electrochemical processes, those are non-rational. Why would we assume that they produce rational thinking? Because ultimately, I mean, and your argument here, I guess, Frank, is it undercuts the whole project.
It's this idea, it's almost sort of existential. You know, why should we believe anything if there's no guidance? To me, it's like asking the question, like you said earlier, about, you know, how do we know that we even exist, or that the universe wasn't created last Thursday? Mm. For me, it's somewhat based on consensus. It doesn't prove it's true, but reason is one of those things that we need to assume in order to get anywhere. In the same sense, we need to assume that we exist in order to have a philosophical discussion.
No, that's a very wise point. I agree with you. The question is, how do we explain reason on a naturalistic worldview?
Well, reason and consciousness can be explained as coming about through evolution. The way in which we sense the world.
But let's stop there for just a second, though, Alex. If that's the case, why should we trust it?
Oh, well, we don't necessarily have to. Again, it's a subjective thing. But every single person.
But that would mean reason's subjective.
Yes, it is.
Well, if reason is subjective, then...
If reason's not subjective, then how do you and I come to different conclusions, using reason?
Because we have free will. If reason's subjective, we couldn't even communicate. If there weren't these objective, unchanging laws of logic...
Well, yes, there are objective rules and tenets of reason, but reason itself is subjective. In the same way that morality, you can say, under certain assumptions, there are objective truths about morality. If you have a certain assumption about reason, then yes, there are objective tenets.
Well, that's what I mean. These immaterial laws of logic that aren't made of molecules... How do we explain those on a naturalistic worldview?
How do you mean? How do we explain?
Why are there laws of logic? Why are there laws of mathematics?
They're a product of consciousness. And laws of mathematics are not a thing in themselves, but rather a way to explain the universe. So the laws of mathematics would not exist without human beings. So they are subjective. But the things that they describe would.
Oh, no, hold on.
So when you talk about logic, when you talk about reason, these things aren't ends, they're means. They're means to understanding certain things. So we use reason to understand that the Earth goes around the sun. We use the laws of maths to understand how that happens.
But you just said the laws of mathematics are human conceptions, basically.
Yes, it's a language.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Let's say there were no human beings on the Earth and there were just two rocks on the Earth. Was it true there were just two rocks on the Earth?
Well, it depends what you mean by two. I mean, sure, like you, if
in the everyday sense of the word.
This is where things get confusing, because, for instance, I suppose what you're asking is something similar to the question of, does 2 plus 2 still equal 4 if there are no humans? Mm-hmm. And to me, the case is you have to think about what you're describing when you say 2 plus 2. So, for instance, if you're saying if there were two rocks and you added two more rocks, mm-hmm. would there be four rocks? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But to say that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is like is a good way to bring in the idea that mathematics is a language, because in the same way that I can say...
But it's not an arbitrary language.
Well,
In fact, language itself is based on mathematics, and that's not arbitrary.
I'd say it's absolutely arbitrary.
Math is arbitrary?
No, math isn't, but the language we use to describe it is. It evolves and changes.
Well, yes, but they're referencing objective facts. If we want to call this one book... Mm-hmm. There is only one book here.
Yes.
Okay, that's an objective fact. If we wanted to call it eins, like in Deutsch, that this is one book. Okay, that's a different word, but mm-hmm. it's representing the same objective fact. And if we're going to say that reasoning is objective, then there's no way we can come to any conclusions about anything.
There are different ways, even within the laws of mathematics.
Did I say objective or subjective?
I don't recall that.
If we're going to say reason is subjective, then there's no way we can come to any conclusions about anything. But that's self-defeating, because when I say that, I'm making a truth claim. That if reason is subjective, then we can't come to any true conclusions about anything. That actually is an objective truth claim.
Well, I would say that even with something as objective as maths, mm-hmm. there are subjective ways in which to understand it, the language we use, even though it seems that it wouldn't be the case. For instance, if you want to find the roots of a quadratic equation, you can do it by using the quadratic formula. You can do it by expanding the brackets, and you get to the same answer. But the reason you're using to get there is subjective. So the answer is a fact of nature. It's true. That would still be the answer, even if humans didn't exist. But the language we used to get there, and the reason that we used to get there, wouldn't.
Yeah, but the reason is objective, but there's different levels here. You have ontology, which is the study of being.
Sure.
Okay. You have epistemology, that's how we know the study of being. Then you might have semantics, which is how you describe the epistemology to get to the ontology.
Sure.
This can be arbitrary, but it's still tethered to objective facts. It's ultimately tethered to an objective ontology.
So what are the tenets of objective reason to you?
Well, start with the basic laws of logic that they're...
For instance...
The law of the excluded middle, things like that.
Law of non-contradiction, law of excluded middle, law of inference, law of identity. Those are the essentials of the laws of logic. And you start with those, and then you use your sense perceptions to draw conclusions about the real world using those tools, those objective laws
of
logic.
Exactly. They're tools. And this is the thing that I see when we're talking about whether reason exists. Reason is a method. And so it
helps us in epistemology, but if they weren't tethered ontologically, if they weren't tethered to reality, there'd be no way we could know anything about
reality.
You're
making the claim that this realm exists that we call the laws of logic and so on, and that it really is something that we discover in that sense. It's an element of the reality we live
in. We don't determine them, we discover them.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas you're making the case, obviously,
that reason is not something we discover.
We produce. It's something we invent because it helps us.
That's an objective truth claim right there. That's why it's self-defeating. Alex is saying it's objectively true that reason is subjective.
And the same applies to the moral argument as well, which is you're saying there's this realm of real right and wrong, good and evil. And you're saying, no, these are just concepts we invent. We don't discover them, but we invent them. And I know many people whose journey to belief in God has been based on the fact that they came to the view that there really is a realm of right and wrong that I discover. I no longer believe that it's all subjective. And obviously others who take your view as well, Alex. I mean, fundamentally, is that where do we just come to an impasse where you say, Frank, there is real realms of, you know, these objective laws of logic and there's real realm of good and evil. And you just say, no, in my opinion, it can all be explained as a subjective. Because ultimately, I believe in objective moral good and evil because for me, I see that as a bit like I see racism is wrong is the same as 1 + 1 = 2. But you say no, that racism doesn't exist when humans don't exist.
I agree with you that I see it as the same. To me, they are both as instinctual.
Yeah.
But that 1 + 1 = 2 is again, it's a mathematical language. But if you're talking in the literal sense that one thing and another thing equals two things, then yes, that is objectively true. But to say that racism is wrong, although it feels just as instinctively true. It doesn't have the same objective grounding in reality.
Say you were living a few hundred years ago in the American South, and maybe racism is kind of just part of the culture. That's the accepted way of things, at least within the white population, let's say. Because that's the generally accepted de facto, you know, way of people thinking about it, would that mean racism is okay in that culture? Because that's...
Well, it's a difficult question. I would say no. If you dropped me in that culture, I would say no.
But if you had grown up in that culture, you'd probably say yes, because it's subjective.
You might find people who would argue that it is, and it is a subjective opinion. But I think now, because we have... It's not just a case that we've developed our understanding of morality. We've made it better.
You're dropping in a moral claim there. You've said it's better, which suggests it's traveling
but again,
towards
when,
something,
when I say better,
an
I'm,
objective standard.
I do admit I'm making the assumption that we are striving for human prosperity, which is an absolute assumption. That isn't objectively good, but it's instilled with us within evolution. I can't explain why this thing is good, but it just... When I say good, I don't
mean it's still just your preference.
When I say good,
you happen to
good
believe.
And evil, the words we use for me are just emotional translations of the words beneficial and detrimental.
I like what Louise Anthony said in her debate with William Lane Craig. Louise Anthony is an atheist, but she admitted something about morality and atheism that I think is very insightful. Here's what she said. This is her quote. She said, "Any argument for moral skepticism will be based upon premises which are less obvious than the existence of objective moral values themselves." In other words, here she is as an atheist saying, I have this sense of moral obligation that is so strong that any argument you give me for atheism or moral subjectivism will be based on the weaker premises than just the sense that I have that objective moral values and obligations exist. So that was my question originally to you, Alex, is why would you deny the strongest belief that you have intuitively and adopt a weaker belief in atheism or agnosticism?
Well, I don't deny it, because I don't deny, like I say, as long as I do have certain assumptions and I admit that there are assumptions, I can say that I have an objective sense that these things are wrong on the assumption that I'm aiming for human prosperity.
Right, but you already pointed out that Sam Harris is begging the question on that. That is his human flourishing. And that's a conflation of epistemology and ontology. And as you pointed out, rightfully so, and 18 years old, he's already figured this out, which I didn't know this is 18, that Sam Harris is confusing epistemology and ontology. He's assuming what he's trying to prove.
But the problem with Sam Harris's argument is he's going in there trying to show that certain things are right or wrong based on science. What I'm trying to do is say why people experience things as right or wrong based on science, which can be done. So I can say the reason that I feel that this is right and wrong is because of this. What I can't say is that this is right or wrong because of this.
I mean, does this mean, is it a problem for you then, telling people what they ought to do? Because there's a sense in which, you know, if you see a society being racist or treating women unequally or whatever it might be.
Or Catholic priests abusing children like you do on your website, you say that's wrong?
For me, the problem has always been, for the atheist who denies objective morality, is what right do you have to tell someone else? Because they're just acting according to their subjective preferences.
Well, the subjective preferences, I find, in these cases, we often agree. So, for instance, if I meet a member of the Ku Klux Klan, we can find common ground in the sense that I might say, okay, so why is this wrong? Why is that wrong? Why? Until we get to the final point and they say, well, I think that it's because my worldview is better for humanity. And I say, well, hang on, so do I. I think my worldview is better for humanity. So let's go on the assumption that what we want is to get what's best for humanity. And here's how I think my worldview leads to that. So even people...
But if they say, but I don't believe black people are human, what do you say to that?
Well, that's the thing. Then the discussion becomes trying to prove how they are.
Right.
It you sort of remove the need for a basis once you find out what the basis of their beliefs are. Once you find that common ground, for instance, me and you agree, you and I agree that, for instance, I assume that we would agree that human flourishing is a good thing.
Oh, sure.
But you would say that that's because you have that in you because of God. I say that I have that in me because
it's
of evolution.
Not just because it's in me, but because there's an objective standard of goodness outside of ourselves.
Absolutely.
And
fine.
So when you say that we can agree that we want to have a better society, as Justin pointed out earlier, you're implying a best. Because in order to say something's better or worse, you have to imply a best. Well, what is that best? What is the ontological grounding of that best?
Not necessarily. You don't have to have. This reminds me of one of Thomas Aquinas' famous five ways, the degrees of perfection. Mm-hmm. There doesn't need to be an absolute perfection to have an idea of something which is more perfect than something else. And to your reference of C.S.
Lewis...
No,
I think there would have to be a standard of perfection or a standard that you're aiming for to say you're getting closer to that standard or further away, better or worse.
It's like your reference to C.S. Lewis. Uh-huh. You can't know a crooked line without having some idea of straight. I don't think that's true. For instance, think of it this way.
Why is it not true?
It's not a case, if you're talking about good and evil, you don't need evil to know good. If you think about, say you have a flat plane.
You're absolutely right about that.
Think about you have a flat plane.
You don't need evil to know good. I agree with you. So, you need good to know evil, though.
I don't think so either. If you have a flat plane, you can see like a hill, like an indentation on that flat plane. Now, the rest of that plane is not a valley. You don't need the valley to understand the hill. You just need the hill in comparison to what is neutral. So you can have evil compared to what is neutral. You can have good compared to what is neutral. You don't need the two extremes.
What would be your definition of evil?
my definition of evil? Well, that's a very broad thing. But if you're asking me, again, subjectively, anything I would say that unwarrantedly elicits human suffering or animal suffering to an extent.
Okay,
as
well. So that would imply that it's the opposite of human flourishing. So it's very difficult to define evil without reference to good.
Not necessarily. It's not. It's so, it may be the opposite of human flourishing, but it's also just the absence of. Like
of good
no, of no suffering, not necessarily good, but no evil.
Okay,
I don't know. I don't know if I'm getting my point across very well.
I think you're both doing a great job at representing your different sides. I guess the thing that I'm really interested in pulling out there, just to bring us back to that racism example, is can you sort of say that racism has always been wrong, was wrong in every culture, time and place where it was practiced in the past? You not actually say that a subjectivist?
I would say if we're assuming that human prosperity is a good thing, and by good we mean best for human prosperity, then yes, racism has always been wrong. Yes,
right,
but only on that assumption.
Yes,
which
of
is
course.
An assumption
and for the racist,
assumption we all share. Maybe not the racist. Yeah. In fact, no. The racist does share the assumption that human prosperity is a good thing.
They may not. They may think prosperity is the best thing. I want to live a selfish life that, you know, disregards
this
other people's
preferences.
This is true,
but if we did have a racist...
But the problem is, how do you... Again, all I'm saying is, and I think you're agreeing with me, is simply that there's no objective way of sorting between these different preferences people
harsh...
have. There's no actual sort of thing that says
yes.
This is the correct way. We should all be, wanting this human flourishing.
It's a harsh reality. I don't like...
There's no way of grounding
it. It can
that.
Make me uncomfortable, the idea that there is no objective, as far as I'm concerned.
And
no
so do you understand Frank's view here, which is he sees that as such an obvious thing that you would have to... The premises... against that, if you like, would have to be much, much stronger than they are
to take away
his instinctive
entirely.
View that this is really actually an objective reality.
I understand entirely. Think about hunger.
Mm.
Hunger is within all of us.
Yeah.
And it is such a strong thing. Mm. We like if somebody is dying of starvation, that is all they care about. It is within them. But it's still a process of evolution. It's still a subjective psychological experience. It's not some kind of transcendental...
Hang on, Alex. Let me just ask you a question about that, because as Justin pointed out in his interview with Richard Dawkins a number of years ago, which is, by the way, in the new book, Unbelievable.
I don't need a publicist when I've got Frank in the studio.
It's a great book. Justin rightfully said... Well, you tell the story, Justin, about how you said he was stepping outside of the evolutionary process.
I kind of had this interesting conversation in my very first encounter with Richard Dawkins, and I asked him whether all our morality is essentially a product of undirected evolution, whether he can really say that rape is wrong. And he says, well, I do believe rape is wrong. Now, that may be a product of my evolutionary past, but that's a value judgment I'm going to make. And I said, but how do you make that value judgment? You have to step outside of this evolutionary process to say that's wrong. And he said, well, maybe, but it doesn't show that anything supernatural exists. And I said, but as far as you're concerned, the fact that we've believe rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact we've evolved five fingers rather than six. And he said, basically. And I agree on naturalism, that is true, but most people recoil at that idea that our morality is essentially arbitrary.
Yes. But in the same sense, this is what frustrates me about atheists a lot, is they'll do the same thing but the opposite. They'll look at God and they'll think of the evil. They'll listen to Hitchens talk about some celestial North Korea and they'll recoil at that and they'll say, that's a horrible thing, I can't imagine that reality. But I'm sorry, just because you don't like a reality doesn't make it not real. And so if there are objective, if there are no objective morals, then unfortunately what Joseph Stalin did in the USSR was not objectively wrong. But that's not a shocking thing to say if we're under the assumption that nothing is objectively wrong.
Do you understand then why for many people the moral argument is so powerful?
Absolutely.
Because they cannot get themselves to a point of view where those kinds of acts are only really about people's
but
preferences.
But I don't think that's what Frank is necessarily doing, because I think you're right that a lot of people do just recoil in horror at the idea of there being no objective standard, but I don't think that's what you're doing. I'd say that you're being cleverer than that. You're understanding that, yes, this is a bad idea, but more than that, you're saying that there's some way to prove that there is an objective reality,
right.
not just because you don't like...
Yeah, I want to get beyond that, or maybe I should say underneath that, going back to Justin's point. And it's this: if you say this is all the result of evolution, you have to get outside the evolutionary process to believe that thought is true. Because if that thought is a result of the evolutionary process as well. Why believe it?
But again, it's existentialism. We have to have certain assumptions.
Well, what I'm saying, this isn't just an assumption. This is what we would call a properly basic belief. It's not just an assumption that I believe that torturing babies for fun is wrong. I think that's really true. It's not my assumption.
Well, in I would say that, for instance, my belief that torturing babies is wrong is also a belief, but that's a belief based on the assumption that human flourishing is a good thing.
We're going to go to a break, guys, and we'll come back to this. Fascinating stuff today. And I hope it doesn't sound too much like it's two against one in this one, Alex.
Not at all.
But it's one where I've always found the moral argument a fascinating one because it does...
Likewise.
Whereas, I guess, cosmological arguments, they're about what's out there. I think this is very much about what's in here, in our personal response to evil and good and so on. But anyway, great stuff. Does evil show that God exists is the debate today. Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor joining me in studio. Come back again in a few moments' time and we'll conclude today's discussion. Can you be a proud patriot and a citizen of heaven? In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the role politics, prejudice and patriotism will play in the UK's general election. And as grime artists Stormzy and Kendrick Lamar talk about faith on their latest records, we look at the gospel according to hip-hop. Plus, meet the man at the forefront of an unprecedented revival in South America for the last three decades. All that plus much more. Ask for a free sample copy of our June issue at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. If you want to find out more about the programme, download past episodes, subscribe to the podcast, see some of the resources and much more besides, it's all available from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You want access to this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and MP3 CD? Look no further than the Premier Shop, premier.org.uk/shop. For that, you can pre-order it now. It's available also as a digital download. And of course, Unbelievable the book. We're extending the range of things that are available under the Unbelievable umbrella. And of course, I'm very excited about the book, which really tells the story of the show over the last 10 or more years and why I'm still a Christian after all these discussions and debates with non-believers. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. It's been really fun, actually, to be doing a lot more interviews, being on the other side of the microphone, if you like, when it comes to other people asking me questions about the book. If you listen to other podcasts, the Nomad podcast, I was recently on there talking about the history of the show, faith, reason, doubt, and also, of course, the book, and the Young Minds Big Questions podcast as well. I did those recently. And I've got a few radio interviews as well lining up and some magazine features and other things. So it's exciting times. Do make sure to let other people know about the book as well. That's all available from unbelievablebook.co.uk. You can even download a free sample chapter there if you're not sure. You can try before you buy here on Unbelievable. Still to come later on, we're going to be hearing your feedback, of course, to recent editions of the programme. Let me tell you that next week it's an exciting show. Mike Licona and Richard Burridge are joining me. Mike Licona, well known as a Bible scholar, particularly in terms of the resurrection. He's got a new book out from Oxford University Press. It's called Why Are There Differences in the Gospels? He's looking at the genre of the Gospels as ancient biography, building very much on the work of another Bible scholar who'll be joining us, Richard Burridge, and particularly looking at the way that another ancient biographer, Plutarch, rearranged, reorganized and adapted his material in ways that make a lot of sense of what the gospel writers were doing when we look at some of the differences between the gospels. You can hear their conversation, not a combative one this time, very much a scholarly, collegial one on next week's programme. That's between 2:30 and 4, as usual, here on Premier Christian Radio and available on the website and the podcast, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And just before we get into the final part of our discussion today, another reminder, told you this last week, but this is your last chance. We're having Paul Copan come into studio soon. He's a brilliant Christian philosopher. He's over in the UK at the moment, normally out in the States. He's going to be joining me for a programme where we put your questions to him. It's a grill Paul Copan edition of the programme. If you have questions on philosophical arguments for and against God, do let me know. Do send them in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I'll put as many of those as I can to Paul. You can also leave them, of course, via Twitter and Facebook as well. At UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to leave it there at the Facebook page as well. He's got a new book out called A Little Book for New Philosophers, but he's also written, of course, on how do we understand violence in the Old Testament and that kind of thing. So there might be various things that you want to ask of Paul Copan. Make sure those questions are with me by the end of Tuesday, the 13th of June. Otherwise, I won't be able to include them in the programme. Right now, time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We've been having a fantastic discussion today. Does evil show that God exists? It's the old chestnut, the moral argument for God. And there are various ways in which atheists respond to this. The way that Alex O'Connor, my atheist guest today, responds is that he doesn't believe there is such a thing as objective good, right or wrong. It's a subjective thing. It's just a product of our evolutionary background. And although it feels like some things really are right and wrong, no, it's ultimately just down to the preferences we develop that are enculturated into us through our biology, through our culture, and so on. That may be a hard pill to swallow, he says, but that's the way it is. We you know, reality doesn't owe us meaning, good and evil, and everything else. A lot like what Richard Dawkins has said in many of his works. On the other side, Frank Turek today has made this video that Alex was responding to on his YouTube channel, saying it may just be that evil disproves atheism, because in his view, the fact that most people affirm evil means that they must affirm good, and you only really get a concept of good if there's a God. Well, we've been around the houses debating that, debating objective and subjective morality. I mean, let's maybe just in the final minutes we have here, gentlemen, talk about one other issue you raised in your original video, Alex. Morality often is blurred, you say. You know, you raise examples of abortion and sexuality. These tend to be, though, questions involving humans and whether things bring harm or good along to them. And there, for you, that showed you that ultimately the morality is human-centric. It's subjective in that sense.
This is my burden of proof. Yeah. This is what I'm saying by it is simply that my argument in general is to say that, again, I'm not explaining necessarily why things are right or wrong, but, mm-hmm. but why we experience them as such. And certain places where we find moral ambiguity is such as issues like abortion, like you say. The problem with, if you ask me, isn't, we're not deciding here, is it okay to kill a human life or not? Mm-hmm. The abortion debate is surrounded around, is that a human life or not? If it is, then it's wrong to kill it. And to me, that's based upon the assumption of human flourishing, which again, I think is instilled by evolution. So it seems to me that this assumption of human flourishing that can be perfectly well explained through the evolutionary process seems to be a very compelling grounding for the experience of morality, especially when you consider things such as these moral ambiguities where they are based upon whether or not we're harming life or not. Mm. Same thing with animals.
Yeah, I'd like to just reiterate that if the evolutionary process gives us our moral ideas, it also gives us all of our ideas, so why should we believe any of them? But secondly, not every issue needs to be crystal clear on morality for God to exist. You know, scientists disagree over aspects of the objective world, sure. But that doesn't mean there isn't an objective world. That's a difference between, again, epistemology and ontology. We all agree there's an objective world. We may not agree on certain aspects of that objective world in science.
This is the very kind of conversation. I had a bit of a Twitter spat last week with an atheist. We were talking about objective morality, and one of the things he said was the fact that people disagree about morality means that it is subjective.
Yeah, see, I don't buy into that.
So you don't buy into that?
No, not at all.
Because that's often the assumption. If we disagree about something, it must be subjective.
It's silly. It can be confused. I'm not trying to say that because we disagree on things, because people disagree on things like sexuality and abortion, therefore morality must be subjective. Yeah. What I'm saying is that if you are trying to propose the view that morality can be explained through evolution, this is bolstered by the fact that the certain things that we do have moral ambiguities on seem to align with that. We don't discuss whether or not murder is right or wrong, because, and to me, the reason for that is because of the fact that it involves human flourishing, human survival. Mm. If the question is, will this act cause humans to suffer? Will this act cause a human to die in the instance of abortion? That's why that moral ambiguity exists. Mm. And so to me, the point is basically that this is evidence of an evolutionary basis for morality.
Well, no, I would say, as you mentioned earlier, on abortion, if it is a human being, you don't kill it. That's not mysterious at all. The only question is it a human being? And I think scientifically we can show it is a human being. People just don't like that. I think many a times the reason people disagree on morality is not because they don't know the right thing to do. They just don't want to do it. In fact, there are some on the other side of the pond in my country who are saying now, yeah, we know it's a human being, but that's okay. We get to kill it anyway.
There are even those who have proposed infanticide. You know, mm-hmm. Peter Singer has made the case that because a newborn baby doesn't have any of the faculties that we develop as we go on in terms of our mental abilities and so on, they shouldn't be counted necessarily as having the same kind of rights for personhood that, you know, a 3-year-old would have, to say. Mm. Now, that's obviously, again, he's just shifted the issue into, like, not whether we're human or not, but whether we have this quote-unquote personhood issue.
Yeah, this is incredibly murky, one of the issues perhaps with proposing objective morality, because what we're saying with something like this, there's always going to be exceptions to the rule. Mm. For instance, when we talk about hunger earlier being a natural instinctive thing within us, there are people who are anorexic, there are people who are obese. Yeah. There are exceptions, but that doesn't mean that evolution can't explain how we experience morality. It doesn't necessarily mean that these things are right or wrong. Yeah. This is the thing I think we're disagreeing on. I'm not saying because of evolution, killing a human is wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that because of evolution, the reason that we don't want to kill humans can be explained.
But do you see, or maybe I'm not explaining myself clearly, Alex, do you see that if evolution has given you your moral beliefs, it's given you all of your beliefs, including the idea that evolution has given your moral beliefs, so why should you believe it? It's either random on evolution or it's designed.
But
so,
I mean, is
if it's designed, you can trust it. If it's random, you can't. So, again, if all your thoughts are the result of the laws of physics, why should you believe any of them?
I might be talking out behind here, but is that not similar to saying, the reason that you're saying the reason I got from evolution, I also got everything else from evolution, mm-hmm. so why should I trust it? Right. Well, the reason that you got from God, you also got everything else from God, so why should you trust God?
Well, because God has given us the rational ability to make reasonable claims or discover truth about reality.
Hasn't evolution given me the rational ability to uncover truths about reality as well? What's the difference?
Because our minds are trustworthy if they're made in the image of the great mind. Why would they be trustworthy if they're a product of random forces
do you know it's a great mind unless the great mind has instilled that reason within you because, to reason that it is a great
because
mind?
Because I'm going from effect to cause.
Right.
Using
reason.
Yes,
the
by using reason.
God gave you. So you're using the reason that God gave you to prove the reason
that
of God.
God is the ontological foundation of the laws of logic, which allows us then to discover truths about reality.
What I'm saying is that you seem to be doing the same thing as I am. You're saying God is giving you this reason to reason that God is the most reasonable being.
God has given us the tools of reason, which are mm-hmm. objective, they're immaterial, and he's given us the free will to either follow him or reject him based upon what we learn about reality and whether or not we want to follow him.
I mean,
or reject
as I understand Frank's argument, it's one of those, what's the best explanation? We both acknowledge we are completely dependent on these laws of logic, this mm-hmm. rational capacity we all have. Can we explain such a thing on a naturalistic worldview, or is it better explained on a theistic worldview? And obviously Frank's view is, yes, it makes sense that we would be able to trust our rational abilities if there is a rational mind behind the universe. Non-rational universe, a non-rational process by which we came to be, there's no fundamental reason to assume that we are aimed at knowing right from wrong, truth and falsity.
But you do
and so
have
on.
To make certain assumptions. Yeah. Like it does frustrate me that I will never know if I exist.
Yeah,
that gets on my nerves.
Who's asking
it
the question?
Really does. It really gets on my
who's
nerves.
Who's wondering, Alex?
This sort of stuff really gets on my nerves. But they are just unanswerable.
Gets on whose nerves? What do you mean?
Well, precisely. But these are just sort of pedantic little things that gnaw away at your mind.
I don't think they're pedantic.
Something like reason. I submit that, okay, you could make the argument that if reason comes from evolution, how can we use that to then reason about evolution? Sure, but I'm saying, is that not the same thing with God?
No, because God is a rational creature, or not creature, he's the ground of rationality.
Says who
gives rational, because we're reasoning from our rationality
right,
back
using
to
the reason that came from where?
Well, of course, his ontological nature has given us these laws of logic to discover truth.
How do you know that? Through reason.
Right. You can't defend reason by reason because that would be circular.
Precisely.
Right. But what we're saying is once we have reason, what better grounds it? Naturalism, which couldn't explain the laws of logic to begin with, or a mind whose very essence grounds these laws.
What you've just said is you said, okay, so we assume that reason exists. What's the best grounding? Mm-hmm. When I give you a grounding, you then say, but how do you know that reason even exists? How can you say that reason exists if it's just a process
because
of this? So I could put the same thing to you. I could say, if reason does exist, what's the best grounding? And you say God. And then I could say the same thing and say, well, if you're getting that reason from God, how can you use that reason to then prove God?
Because that's how you prove anything.
Right. That's how you prove evolution.
Again, no, because in evolution, everything is predetermined. There is no free will. We're just the result of the laws of physics. No, not everything.
God is omniscient. He knows the future. How can there be free will?
Because knowing the future doesn't mean he's causing it to occur.
Well, is he not causing it to occur?
He's the primary cause. Now we're getting to predestination evolution. I don't know if we're predestined to get into
show.
This point.
That's another show we'll have to come back.
No. I'm not a 5-point Calvinist, if that's what you're saying.
But not at all. Let's leave it there for the moment. Before we open up too many more big topics.
I think we'll have to agree to disagree.
As we often do on this show. Look, guys, I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, it's
today.
Great.
Likewise.
Thank you so much. And you are a gracious combatant, Alex. Thank you for coming in again to do that. Frank,
thank you.
Great stuff from you as well. If people want to find out more about you, crossexamine.org for Frank and, of course, the book, Stealing from God. Alex O'Connor, he can be found as Cosmic Skeptic with a K on the YouTube channel he runs. And, I think this will turn into a video as well at some point as well, won't it?
Perhaps, yes. I'd like to think so.
Great. Well, thank you both for being with me.
Thank you.
On the show today. Really great
to
have you on.
Thank you.
Look forward to maybe getting you guys together again at some point in the future. But for the moment, if you want to get in touch, we'll be giving you the ways to do that again in a moment's time here on the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent programmes.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Look forward to getting your emails about today's show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And as ever, you can get in touch via the social media. Twitter is @unbelievablejb, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to find us on the Facebook page of the show. Don't forget that straight after today's programme as well, we've got the profile. I'll be sitting down with Carlos Anacondia. He is an Argentinian evangelist, got some extraordinary stories to tell, and also looking at the charismatic revival that's taken place over the last 2 decades or so in South America. That's coming up straight after this week's edition of Unbelievable. Quick shout out for Andy Peck. Andy is another presenter here on Premier Christian Radio, and I know a regular listener via podcast of the Unbelievable podcast. He's also someone who leads seminars on how to answer questions about your faith for CWR. They take place at Waverley Abbey House. That's in Farnham, Surrey. And he's got one coming up on Thursday, the 6th of July. You never know when someone might ask you to explain why you're a Christian or why bad things happen to good people or other big questions. But Andy says there is help out there, and he's aiming to give you some. It's happening, as I say, Thursday, the 6th of July, 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Special group booking offer as well. You can book online via the website for CWR. That's cwr.org.uk/training. You can find details about it there. There's also a number you can ring Monday to Friday, 01252 784 719. But that's Andy Peck leading an apologetics day, how to answer questions about your faith, very much aimed at people without necessarily having much experience in this area. And Andy, I know, is a brilliant teacher and communicator. So again, Thursday, 6th of July, 2017 at Waverley Abbey House in Farnham, Surrey, where CWR's offices are based. And you find out more at cwr.org.uk. We got some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. Thanks to those who've been in touch from various parts of America. CJ Thompson says, greetings from Detroit. I'm a long-time listener, first time writing in. Like to say how grateful I am for the Unbelievable programme. As an aspiring apologist, I find your discussions enormously helpful in sharpening my mind, fostering my faith and empowering my evangelism. I also want to thank you for creating thoughtful dialogue, cordial and fair to both sides. I also find your story deeply inspiring because although I have a passion for apologetics, I often doubt my knowledge and capabilities in the field. As I understand it, you don't even know the meaning of the word apologetics at the time you started Unbelievable, yet God's used you in incredible ways through the show. That reassures me, gives me hope that God can use a willing believer where they're at. I absolutely can't wait to learn more about your story when I receive my pre-ordered copy of your book. Until then, I will continue to feed my desire to learn with my usual materials, namely your podcast. Speaking of which, you have a few brief topic suggestions. Animal suffering, you'd love to do one on that before the fall. Ronald Osborne, Kyle Keltz, Christopher Southgate, Daniel Breyer or Michael Murray, just to name a few, would make great possible guests. This would effectively cover an array of subjects, including but not limited to original sin, evolution, the problem of evil and suffering, and the nature of God. Congratulations on the book. Thanks again for the show. God bless. Thank you, CJ. We have had, of course, I don't know if you're aware, in the podcast archive, you'll find a show on this issue with Michael Murray, who you name as one of those possible guests. And yes, it was with, I believe, Skydive Phil. So if anyone is aware of Skydive Phil's recent appearances on the programme, you'll know that that was a really interesting debate. You might have to go back a few years, though, to find that in the podcast archive. You also send in your deepest condolence to those affected by the terror attack in Manchester and in London. Thank you very much for your thoughts and prayers, CJ. Johan Carlson got in touch on Facebook, says, as so many of the people who message you have read out on the show, I finally come around to writing to you after some time of listening. I'm one of those people who've gone through the back catalogue of the programme and listened to very many shows, probably half the whole list, choosing the ones that are of extra interest to me. My reason for writing is to express how much I've enjoyed the show and what's more, how much I appreciate your way of hosting it. There's a kind of humbleness, kindness, honesty and seriousness about it that's becoming more and more scarce these days. I also find you quite sufficiently and frankly positively, surprisingly impartial, considering the nature of the station. I'm an atheist from one of the most secularised countries in the world, Sweden, where agnosticism is the default position. I went from agnostic, even at one point searching for God and praying for him to reveal himself, to atheist, thanks to the God delusion, and thereupon following intellectual exploration of the matter. I always kept my cultural Christian identity, though, enjoying church at holidays and even singing in my mother's church choir for Christmas. What Unbelievable has given me is a lot more respect for the case for faith. I'm still atheistic, but much less uncompromisingly so, after all the hours in your company. Now I listen every Saturday as the show comes out. Hope you'll keep up the great work that you do for many more years. Wish you all the best. Johan, lovely, lovely message. Thank you very much. Appreciate the openness that's obviously come through listening to Unbelievable. And I hope that continues, obviously, in the future. Randy Wannett got in touch on Facebook as well. Says, while I find you a good host generally, Justin, I'm afraid the talk you gave at your recent conference was little more than a series of logical fallacies. When a position is justified by logical fallacies, no matter how many, 0 + 0 + 0 + 0 will never add up to more than zero. That position has not been justified at all. If you're open to understanding the problems inherent in how you've attempted to defend your faith, I am willing. I do hope you would prefer to believe things for good reasons rather than just believe things you would prefer for reasons. Well, Randy, thank you for getting in touch. Obviously, you disagreed with the case I made for God, albeit brief case I made for God in that edition of the programme where I aired my talk from the Unbelievable Conference. Obviously, we could have a great conversation, I'm sure, on why you regarded some of the evidences I gave as logical fallacies. But I appreciate not everyone is going to agree. I want to start a conversation. You know, that's what the book is very much about, saying let's listen to each other more. And here's where I'm coming from. Do obviously, if I can encourage you to get hold of the book, that would, of course, make the case in a little more detail. Now, we've had a number of people also getting in touch about the Buddhist show of a couple of weeks ago. That was fun. That was when I was joined by a Buddhist guest, Alex, and, of course, Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe. Ken, the author of a new book, God Among the Sages, that compares and contrasts Jesus with a number of the founders of the various religions around the world. Tara, I knew you would love this program. You always love these interfaith dialogue programs. Fantastic episode this week, comparing Buddhism to Christianity. Amazing, really amazing. It makes me wonder what your book would have been like if you hadn't focused so intently on battling scientific materialism for 11 years. Perhaps episodes on spiritual experiences within various faith traditions would be valuable to you and the audience. Yes, you naturally greatly value your own spiritual experiences, and they're definitely key to your worldview. However, that's true of any Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, native spiritualist also. You just give great supremacy to your own and those within the Christian community. That is human nature, to value one's tribe above all others. I also agree that anyone listening to these discussions come into them wearing their own set of beliefs. We listen from our own worldview, and we find the elements that reinforce our own worldview. When I listen to both your Hindu guest and this week's Buddhist guest,
I saw the similarities. There is no deity waiting for them to choose the correct God to be saved from damnation, or annihilation in your case. Instead, they view life as a growth experience, a place of learning. These religions come closer to my own perspective. I find them vastly more moral. I do often wonder how you can host such amazing folks knowing that your God will annihilate them. Not because they're unkind, unjust, unloving, but solely for choosing the wrong God or none. This is moral and just to you. I find that very odd. Tara, I think that's a little bit of a caricature of my position. It needs spelling out carefully, but I don't believe that God rejects anyone who truly seeks him. I just believe that that seeking will find its ultimate end in Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not here to judge, you know, the state of anyone's heart who doesn't confess Christ as Lord. But I do believe that anyone who ultimately does see God will confess Christ as Lord. And I'm not going to stand in judgment over people where they are. I appreciate, you know, that people have their different reasons and their different experiences. I can only, of course, speak from my own experience and the fact that I think, as well as having a spiritual experience that I would say is of Christ Jesus, I also see that the objective evidences point towards that as being the best explanation as well. I just don't see that caricature of God annihilating people for happening to have the wrong beliefs as the one that I'm really talking about. Thank you for getting in touch, of course. Teresa Martin also really enjoyed the show on Buddhism. Just wanted to say my reading informed me that Buddhism believes in reincarnation as the means of salvation, but in this, the self or the individual is eradicated at the end of each life. So even though you live on, it's not you as an individual who has any hope of attaining nirvana. Whereas Jesus promised hope to each man and woman as an individual and said to the man on the cross at his crucifixion, "Today you will be in paradise with me." Buddha was a mere man who died and didn't rise from the dead and simply leaves us his teachings. Jesus proved to have supernatural power, claimed and proved to be God in human flesh through his miracles and compassion. Also, he rose bodily from the dead and lives to serve us from the right hand of God. Thank you very much, Teresa, for getting in touch. Thanks to all those who have been in touch. I've got a couple more here on Buddhism and my talk from the other week, but we'll have to leave them there. We're out of time. Great to have your thoughts on the programme, and if you want to get in touch, as usual, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Do send in your questions for Paul Copan by Tuesday, the 13th of June. I'll read as many of those out on that programme recording with him. And do come again for Unbelievable at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
A really fruitful and scholarly dialogue on next week's programme. Very accessible, though. We're going to be asking, why are there differences in the Gospels? That's the name of Mike Licona's new book. And with Richard Burridge, whose work he really builds upon, we're going to be looking at the genre of the Gospels, ancient biography, and what we can learn from other examples of ancient biography about why there may be some of the differences that it's not hard to see between the different synoptic Gospels and John's Gospel. So if you're into that kind of thing, I think you're really going to enjoy next week's programme. Hope you come back again from 2:30 through till 4 next week or online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Thanks for being with me for today's show. Coming up next, The Profile. I'm sitting down with Argentinian evangelist Carlos Anacondia.